Welcome to Our Hen House. This is Jasmine Singer.
And this is Marianne Sullivan.
And on this week's show, Rachel Dreskin of the Plant-Based Food Association will be joining us to examine how the plant-based food industry is a dynamically growing industry that needs to use all the tools that other industries use to support their companies and up their game, and how that is going to happen. I'm so excited about that. I want to hear what's going on with the Plant-Based Food Association. I was actually at an event of theirs in person a few months back and was really, really impressed with all of the things coming down the pipeline.
Oh, yeah. That is exciting to hear about new foods. And this is a good interview. And something that I think we really all need to stay on top of. I mean, like, we are, what they're really trying to do is reach people who aren't us. But we are the core, and you know, finding those new products and supporting them is really important. And it's nice that that's part of helping animals, because it's one of the nicer parts of helping animals. So on the flock bonus segment, I'll be continuing that conversation with Rachel. And if you're a flock member, you'll get a link to that bonus segment in your email on the Tuesday after this podcast episode goes up. You can also always find it on the flock Facebook group. And if you're not a member of the flock and you can afford it, you can join for $10 a month at ourhenhouse.org/donate. Or you could also join for $100 a year and save $20.
Think of all you could do with that $20. That's what we're trying to do. We're trying to help you save money. If you are a flock member, please join us for our flock First Friday Zoom calls, which are once a month on the first Friday of the month at 4 p.m. Eastern, where we have some really inspiring guests. They were previously on the podcast, and we also have some really cool conversations about activism and life in general. That's coming up because First Flock Friday for March is coming up. So if you are a member of the Flock, check out that Flock Facebook group for updates or write to us at info@ourhenhouse.org. You can also sign up for one-on-one meetings with me by emailing info@ourhenhouse.org, and we can chat about your activism and your veganism and your change making and all that. I've really been enjoying those, and I hope to connect with you soon.
I know it is something of a cliche to say this, and I know you're going to make fun of me, but can you believe it's almost March?
I know.
Even though this has been a long winter and we are in a very wintry place that, winter kind of, well, I'm sure winter isn't done with us, but March, how'd that happen? I got to get my car inspected.
Oh, okay. Noted. Thanks
Glad
for sharing.
Glad everybody knows that now.
Mm-hmm. We can all make sure that you're held accountable.
Could you all send me an email?
Yeah. So I did go somewhere, though, this past weekend, which really helped with the sort of mundane part of the world lately, which it feels never ending. It's always that much more exciting to go somewhere. And I got to go to the Corning Museum of Glass. And that's in upstate New York, in Corning, New York. And it was so wonderful. If you're into museums, I definitely recommend it. It's like very elaborate exhibits and just pieces, and it's a fantastic store, most importantly. I really had so much fun. You know, I made these glasses. You know what sandblasting is?
No.
It's basically like if you ever saw like a cloudy glass that you're drinking out of, you know, that was likely sandblasted. I mean, I'm describing it so badly, but you can put shapes in that. So I did this little workshop where I was able to put shapes in a glass and sandblast it, so the shapes become like embedded in the glass. And I made a go vegan glass with all these like animals all over it. So I was able to actually get in a conversation with some of the people in the museum who were helping me about veganism, which it was such a fun little moment of advocacy while doing crafting, which is my favorite thing to do. So I recommend that.
I have to admit, you're much into like, you know, hands-on stuff than I am, but that does sound like fun. I have to get to that museum. I have always heard it's like, even though it's in a small town in upstate New York, and people don't think there's anything in small towns in upstate New York, and sometimes that is literally true. I've always heard that it's a really amazing museum.
Yeah,
that has great exhibits. So I have to get there.
Well, there was this one piece that was like these crows all eating some bloodied carcass, and the bloodied carcass was red glass. It was actually, those were beautiful, the like little red pieces of glass that they were eating. And it was a really powerful piece until I realized that the crows were taxidermied. And I was like, oh, come on.
They were gross.
I know. So that was unfortunate, but at least I got to offset that experience with the, you know, vegan advocacy sandblasting, which was super fun. And it was just really fun to have an adventure out in the world. So speaking of adventures, we have been on quite the adventure of describing and discussing the recent New York Times series of videos that the first two pertained to animal agriculture and factory farming. The first one was about cows, and the second one last week was about chickens, and we've been discussing them. So the third and final installment of this video series came out, and I would say, unfortunately, was about bugs and consuming them.
Unfortunately, doesn't even begin to touch it. It was about eating insects. The first, I mean, if you've been listening to the podcast, you know how much we loved those first. The first one was mostly about the beef industry. The second one was mostly about the chicken industry. They were scathing in their criticism and very clear about the amount of damage, I mean, particularly the environmental damage done by these industries. The animal welfare implications were more, they were less stated than they were shown, but they were definitely there. I mean, we were going on and on and on about how we couldn't believe that the New York Times had actually come through and done something this great. And then their third episode is about eating insects. And not only is it about eating insects and how that's going to fix all of this, and it's got that cute little tone. It's all so cute. It doesn't even mention the fact that there is protein in plants.
Yeah. No, I know. It was so amiss. And it was like, it was so funny to me because the people who were being interviewed and just the whole way that this piece was packaged was like, well, animal agriculture is super unsustainable and we need another way, you guys. We have to think creatively. That was actually one of the sentences. We have to think creatively. We have to come up with new ideas because this isn't going to work. And it's like, talk about missing the forest for the trees. Their creative thinking was to just eat bugs. And that was how they're going to save the world, just by eating bugs. Like, they completely bypassed the fact that we can be fed and sustained and thrive from plants.
Have they not heard of vegans? Like, do they not know that we exist and we haven't died?
I almost wonder if, like, when this was being pitched and, you know, greenlit, I almost wonder if, like, there was an editor somewhere that said, we can't come off too vegan here. Like, the first two were so vegan-y inherently that they were like, well, we need something to not make it seem like we're doing a PSA for PETA. I wonder if there was a part of it that was rooted in that, but, like, come on, you guys.
I don't think so, because they didn't mention it and say, oh, but there's this other idea that you probably haven't heard of. Like, it was like bugs. What we have to do is eat bugs. And no, of course, no mention of whether insects are sentient. And they're talking about, you know, the question of insect sentience, I think also, it's certainly uncertain. It probably depends to some extent on which insects you're talking about, because they vary so widely. But they're talking about crickets here. I think there is a fair amount of evidence. Like, that's just not even, like, never occurred to them. And they made clear that this is big time. This is a big industry. They showed these facilities that are being built to grow crickets and other insects. And clearly, the insect food business has a huge and successful trade association. I mean, no doubt about it, that they got this story placed as if eating insects is the solution. There was even this idiot scientist who was saying, well, what adults should do is pretend they're not grossed out so their kids will just eat them anyway. Like, really? Maybe just eat some broccoli? Maybe a little tofu? You don't have to pretend anything?
The air fryer does wonders, you guys. I was thinking about, too, the fact that, like, they made a case for how lobsters used to be considered really disgusting and, like, you know, a peasant's food, and now is like seen as this sort of hoity-toity, extremely exciting, once in a blue moon type of food that people treat themselves to. And their point was, like, our perceptions change, our experiences change, our history changes. And I was like, right, this is the moment when you mainstream plant-based, you guys. So weird.
It's unbelievable.
I want to still, like, have some kind of appreciation for the series as a whole, because, like, two out of three ain't bad. And
oh, Meatloaf died.
As Paula Abdul, who didn't die, said, two steps forward, one step back. So out of three videos, not so bad, right?
Well, but you're more generous than I am. I feel completely set up, and I feel like the New York Times once, you know, we've been talking for 2 weeks how shocked we were because the New York Times always has that tongue-in-cheek, just totally privileged attitude about, you know, just talk about what you want to eat and really insensitive to the issues. And we were so impressed for 2 weeks. Now they've shown their true colors.
Okay. Well, let's change topics to something that I think is more exciting and much more aligned with everything we stand for because we created it, which is the Animal Law Podcast, and a new episode came out. I'd love it if you could just tell the Our Hen House listeners what they'll find when they listen to the new episode of the Animal Law Podcast.
Yeah, it's a cool one. And I've been wanting to have Charlotte Blattner on for a long time. She is Swiss. She's an amazing animal attorney. She's super, super smart. She has all sorts of qualifications. And she teaches at, I think, the University of Bern in Switzerland. But this had to do with a ballot initiative in Basel. We were in Basel. Do you remember that?
I loved it. Yeah, totally remember, of course.
So they had this ballot initiative, and it was specifically for the rights of primates. And she was working with an organization. I mean, she wasn't employed by them, but she was working with some people from an organization called Sentience. They ran into so many legal problems in trying to get this ballot initiative on the ballot. And I'm not going to pretend to you that they won, because they didn't win, which is sad. But I think that her interview really shows how much progress can be made and how important it is to try these things and see what happens. And then it can point out the way to the next step, which might be just to bring it again. You know, it opens up a conversation, and sometimes that conversation doesn't result in success the first time around. So yeah, Charlotte Blattner, check it out. It's a great episode.
Be sure to subscribe to the Animal Law Podcast. And thanks, Marianne. I know that the Animal Law Podcast is something we all look forward to. And speaking of looking forward to things, I'm very much looking forward to our interview today. So let's get to that. As the leader of the Plant-Based Foods Association, the first and only U.S. trade association for plant-based food companies, Rachel Dreskin enables the continued success and effective scaling of the industry on behalf of its more than 220 member brands. She is also the CEO of the Plant-Based Food Institute, PBFA's sister nonprofit dedicated to driving transformation to a plant-based food system. Prior to joining PBFA, which is a mouthful, Rachel served as U.S. Executive Director at Compassion in World Farming. She will be joining Marianne right after this.
Social media has become such an important part of almost all of our lives. So please make Our Hen House part of that social media experience for you. You can like us on Facebook. You can follow us on Twitter or Instagram. We try to post some news stories to help you keep up to date on what's happening in the world for animals. You can also find us online, of course, on our website, ourhenhouse.org, or you can email us. If you have some concerns or questions or something you'd like us to discuss on the podcast, let us know. info@ourhenhouse.org. Welcome to Our Hen House, Rachel.
Thank you, Marianne. Good to be here.
It is lovely to have you here. I am really excited to catch up on what the Plant-Based Food Association is doing. And I think before we start with those kind of details, it would be very useful to me and probably to some of our listeners for you to just tell us what a trade association does, because it's not something we're all familiar with.
So the Plant-Based Food Association is a trade association that represents the plant-based foods industry. We're representing the member companies' interests, and our members are made up of food companies that have plant-based products in their portfolios or are entirely plant-based. So we represent their interests. We champion their interests. We help to defend them and the industry when necessary, and are really looking out for the industry to succeed and scale and thrive.
And is it primarily a political goal? Like, is most of your work done in Washington or in state legislatures advocating for your industry there?
So we have two main parts of our program within the Plant-Based Foods Association. So one part is our policy work, which you mentioned, and we do work both on the federal level and on the state level. And really the focus of that work is to create an even playing field for the plant-based foods industry to succeed. There are a lot of factors at play that make it more difficult for plant-based food brands to succeed and to be able to compete against companies and brands that are centered around animals and animal products. And the other main part of our work is what we call our marketplace work. And that is where we work with retailers, with food service companies, including restaurants and also the companies that cater cafeterias and stadiums, et cetera. And we work to get more plant-based foods into all of those channels. And then we also do that work so that it creates more opportunities for our members. So we work to create more shelf space on supermarket shelves and then work with our members to get their products onto the shelves and into the hands of consumers.
So let's talk about who your members are. I know you can't exactly list them because there's really a lot of them, but can you give us an idea of who would join such an association? I'm particularly interested. Do you represent only manufacturers of packaged foods, or do you also represent like people who sell lentils or tomatoes or whatever? Where are your boundaries for who your members are?
Yeah, so we do have a lot of members. We have about 350 members right now, and most of those are company members. We also have some affiliate members and investor members as well. But the types of company members that we have really range from the super small startup that hasn't even made it into market yet, all the way through to the impossibles and beyond, and everyone in between. And we have companies that go across the different categories. So companies that are making plant-based burgers, companies that are making plant-based chicken or eggs or seafood or baked goods and snacks that are plant-based. But our membership is primarily companies that are providing alternatives to animal products. So you asked whether, you know, a company that manufactures lentils and distributes lentils or, you know, other single ingredients could be a member. And the technical answer is yes. The criteria for membership within the Plant-Based Foods Association is that you must have products that are completely plant-based and don't have any animal derived ingredients. But the work that we do is really focused on those alternatives. So we're not going to Washington and lobbying on behalf of the tomato industry necessarily. So the companies that find the most benefit from what we do are those companies that are providing alternatives to animal products.
And just to clarify, since so many meat companies now are getting into this field, they would not be eligible for membership in the Plant-Based Food Association because they're not completely plant-based. Is that right?
So we welcome, the criteria is that a company has to have products that are completely plant-based. So a company who does have animal products in their portfolio but is getting into plant-based could join the Plant-Based Foods Trade Association.
I misspoke then. I just want to make sure that people understand that I misspoke. Yeah. So that makes a lot of sense to me. So if Smithfield wants to make a plant-based product, Smithfield can give you money to support that.
They could. The thing that is interesting about the Plant-Based Food Association, which I think is really important, though, is the governance of the organization, in that our board, which is made up of companies, of plant-based food companies, has to be majority completely plant-based food brands. And that's because we are really a mission-driven organization. And the vast majority of our membership, and I think just companies that are getting into the plant-based food space, are so mission-driven. So that is a requirement from the governance level, from the board.
So you don't want Smithfield taking over.
Right. We have to make sure it's very clear yeah. that we are representing the interests of completely plant-based food brands and products.
Have you seen interest from companies like that have been in, I mean, maybe not Smithfield, but I don't even know whether they make a plant-based product, though so many of the players in the meat industry are getting into it. Like, do you see any interest from companies that do have those products in their production line, but also have a plant-based product joining your organization?
Yeah, there is interest. It's really from almost every major food company, as you said, has plant-based food products now and is getting into that space. So it'll be really interesting over the coming years to see kind of what that evolution looks like and how much those companies invest in efforts to advance the plant-based foods industry. The majority of our membership right now are completely plant-based food companies, but I think it's going to be really interesting to follow what that evolution looks like. And I think about my previous job before I joined the Plant-Based Foods Association. I was the U.S. ED of Compassionate Rural Farming, and we did a lot of work with really big food companies that were producing animal products. And Purdue was one of those companies we worked with to improve the conditions that animals were raised in in order to reduce suffering. And, you know, while we were working with them, Purdue said, you know, they were open to thinking about what the future of their business looked like and said, hey, we're the leader in premium protein. We didn't say chicken protein. We said protein. So I think we're going to see a lot of changes happening in the coming years from some really big businesses because there is such a big shift and what consumers are demanding now is so different than 20, 10, even 2 years ago. So I think in order for these big multinational food companies to stay relevant, they are going to have to invest more in plant-based.
I mean, I know there are a lot of people in the vegan movement who are paranoid, which isn't really surprising because we have every right to be, that, you know, the meat industry just wants to get into this to kill it, like to take it over and then limit it. So, you know, it just remains at best a competitor, but never something that will take it over. But on the other hand, like we can't stop, you know, the bottom line of their business isn't to kill animals. The bottom line of their business is to make money. So, and they're not like the farmers. If they can make money one way, I don't see why they wouldn't. So it will be really interesting. You will be on the front lines of watching how this all plays out in the future. And it should be really fascinating. So getting back to the companies, the most of the companies that you represent and forgetting about, you know, the Smithfields of the world. What are the elements that separate a successful company in this arena from one that doesn't make it?
Really understanding the kind of product that you want to bring to market. And, you know, there's so many, the plant-based foods industry is an industry now, which is something that I make sure to point out now that it's not just a category. It's not just a niche offering. It is a full-fledged industry. And there are products that sit basically at every point of that spectrum. So we have, you know, some products like the Impossible Burger that is a one-to-one, essentially a one-to-one replacement for a beef burger. So if you have a consumer that, a flexitarian consumer that is like, okay, for, you know, whether it's for environmental reasons or health reasons or animal welfare reasons, I'm looking at reducing the amount of meat in my diet, but I still want that same look, that same feel. I want my product to still cook the same way, have the same texture, then an Impossible Burger might be really great for that consumer. There also are consumers that are looking for, you know, what's the most healthful, minimally processed products that I can have that are still convenient. And that would be a very different kind of product. So I think like really understanding where you're sitting within that continuum, that spectrum, and honing in on that consumer that you're looking to appeal to. Also, I think that the innovation is just so important now. And we have just the strides that the industry has made in the past few years is just incredible. And thinking about new areas that we can innovate in. And we're beyond just looking at burgers, you know, and then it was like, you know, all these amazing plant-based chicken products. And there's still so many that are coming down the pike, which is really exciting. But now we're seeing so much innovation when it comes to eggs and seafood and all different kinds of categories, you know, dairy, every kind of dairy product. And, you know, it's not just that people want to say, okay, instead of having a, you know, an animal beef burger, I'm going to have a plant-based burger for dinner. People are looking to incorporate plant-based foods at every point of the day. at every meal. And also now including snack foods as well. So there's a huge amount of opportunity for companies to innovate, come to market with something that is really unique and speaks to what people are looking for.
It really is a moment that is kind of hard to believe. I was in the supermarket yesterday and I noticed that I walked down the aisle where the laundry detergents were, and it was Wegmans' own brand. Wegmans is our local supermarket. And they all said plants on the laundry detergent. It's like the word plant is the most marketable. They'll put the word plant on anything. It's kind of unbelievable.
Right.
And speaking of the supermarket, where do you want the plant-based foods to be? They used to be in their own little, healthy section, and now they're hard to find. Is that how you want it?
That's a great question, because I know for the vegans out there, it's great to have our own dedicated section, because we know exactly where to go and get all of our products and out we go. But it's also thinking about, from my perspective, is thinking about how do we scale the plant-based foods industry? How do we get this into as many people's shopping carts and homes as possible? And making it really easy for people who aren't going to, hunt out that one section of the store to be able to find these products. And we're finding that products, when they are integrated within the sections of the store that have those animal-based products, that the sales increase. We did a study with Kroger a couple of years ago and found that the sales of plant-based increased by 23%, plant-based meats, when they were merchandised or they were sold within the same section of the store that the animal-based meats were sold in. And we're going to be doing a lot more exciting research in that area too, regarding plant-based meats, but also other categories in the plant-based food space. But that indicates to me that integration is really important for moving as much plant-based product as we can, and really appealing to somebody who's going to pick up some ground beef and they see the Impossible or the Beyond or another brand and are like, I'm going to give it a whirl. And the thing is, I think part of the reason why it's so successful to have these products integrated is that the repeat buying rate is really high. It's over 70% of people who are trying these products, and then they're finding out that they like them. And that speaks again to the innovation. They taste really good and they're coming back and then they're buying more. So having them at a place where people who aren't necessarily vegan or vegetarian are able to easily find them, try them, and then go back and buy them again.
Yeah, that's important for us all to remember when we're wandering around the supermarket, unable to find anything, that it's good for the animals. It's good for the animals. So speaking of another product, which I don't know whether it fits into your purview or not, and they're not on the market yet, but what about cultivated meat? If it ever manages to make it to market, we've been talking about it, it feels like for years. Do you expect that to be among the products that you'll be promoting?
I think it's a really interesting space to watch, and technology that has a lot of potential to drive change. As you said, it's not in the market yet. There's still a lot for us to keep an eye on. But it falls, in terms of the Plant-Based Foods Association, it falls outside of what we focus on. So we define plant-based foods as foods made from plants that contain no animal-derived ingredients. So cultivated meats, while really interesting, sit outside of the remit of what we cover.
I know that one of the areas that has been, certainly on the legal front, one of the hottest areas and still going on is, of course, labeling. What are these producers allowed to call these foods? And that's been both at the federal level and the state level. So what would you say is the current state of affairs there? What can companies call their products and feel like they're not going to have to change their packaging at costs of millions of dollars down the road?
Yeah, well, that's something that we're focused on. That's really a focus of a lot of our state work in particular, are those labeling bills, because that makes it so difficult for a company to label their products. First of all, we want to be able to use common terminology so that consumers can easily know and identify the product. So for companies who are producing almond milk or oat milk, being able to call it almond milk or oat milk versus a oat beverage or an almond beverage. And the same thing on the meat side, being able to call a plant-based burger a burger and not a plant-based substitute patty or something that is just much harder to figure out what you're actually talking about. So that is, and when you have these, you know, these labeling bills pop up at the state level, it becomes very tricky for brands because they may be able to call their oat milk in almost every state, but then there's one or two where they have to have a different terminology on the package. So it's something that is top of mind for a lot of our members. So we address every single state where this happens. We are in there and we are fighting these bills as they come up so that our members don't have to deal with this. So that is a big focus for us, but we also are focused as well on not just the defensive work, but right now we are also laying out a proactive strategy, thinking about how do we start to get ahead of this so we don't have to keep, you know, playing this game of whack-a-mole. So that's a strategy that's in the works for us right now. And I'm really looking forward to over the next few years being able to roll that out so that we don't have to be dealing with this in too far into the future.
So you're not gonna tell us about it yet.
Not yet, because it's still in development. But next time I come back, Marianne, I'm going to share more about that.
But there's another side of this labeling issue too, and that's the term plant-based. It's never happened to me, but I've seen a lot of people complain about buying something that was labeled plant-based and it has animal ingredients. So that is a term that apparently has kind of been muddied as well. Like, what is, I think I understand what your definition is, but how are you going to make sure that it maintains that meaning? Because apparently it's not.
That is a top priority for us. And one of the first things that really thought about, what's our strategy on this when I came into this role last year? And it was very important for us right off the bat to make sure we clarified the definition last year to make sure that it was abundantly clear that there may be no animal products within a plant-based foods product, according to the PBFA. But they're still out there where you can get a breakfast sandwich that says plant-based on the front, and it might have an egg from a laying hen or cheese from a cow on that product. And it's happened to me before too, where I've accidentally bought something that had an animal product in it when it says plant-based. And I see that as a major problem. And the majority of our member companies also see that as a major problem. And it's an area that's creating a lot of consumer confusion. So we're doing a lot of work in this area, one of which is ensuring that when consumers are looking for plant-based, that they are looking for products that have no animal ingredients in them. So we're doing some research right now to make sure that we have that on our side, that is what the consumer expectation is. And then the next step is then working with companies that are putting plant-based on products and have animal ingredients. The first priority would be to move to an entirely plant-based product. And, you know, PBFA is in a really great position when it comes to that because we have so many member companies that make plant-based cheeses or plant-based eggs that could easily be, you know, be used in those products. So reformulating products to be completely plant-based would be the top, you know, the first choice. And then after that, it's, you know, it becomes PBFA's, I see it as a responsibility of PBFA to defend the use of that term.
You defend it, you mean in possibly in court, in legislatures?
I mean, that's not what our primary approach would ever be. And I hope it never comes to that, but it is really important for PBFA to defend. And hopefully we can do that in a way in which we're working with companies and brands to reformulate or just remove the terminology.
You know, a few years ago, I had thought that the word vegan was about to disappear from the marketplace because everything was plant-based and you never saw vegan. And now you see the word vegan all the time. It's kind of, I don't know, it had a renaissance. And so how do you weigh in on the vegan versus plant-based terminology? And it's certainly convenient for vegans. I mean, when it says vegan, I just buy it. If it says plant-based, I have to go back to the old school days and read all the ingredients. So which word do you prefer?
So we use plant-based, and A couple of reasons for that. One is that plant-based, I think, has a, you know, for folks who aren't ready to necessarily make a full lifestyle change and just focus on their foods, the plant-based covers that. So if folks want to reduce or eliminate animal products in their diets, then they can go the plant-based route. And maybe they'll look at, you know, other lifestyle choices they can make to go fully vegan at some point. But this, I feel like, is it's very approachable for people who aren't necessarily looking for a full vegan lifestyle because it is so specific to food and diets.
And apparently laundry detergents.
And laundry detergents.
And we have seen that happen. I mean, we all thought that the whole project in front of us was to get people to go vegan. And it turned out vegan food has grown, or plant-based food has grown exponentially, but the number of vegans hasn't. So much for me for predicting how social change happens. So what are the major drivers causing people to want to purchase these products? Is it animal rights? Is it climate? Is it trendiness? Like, this must be a hugely important factor for you to figure out. What drives the interest in these products?
The number one driver is personal health. That is what's leading a lot of people to choose plant-based products. So that has been a top driver, remains a top driver, but there's also some really interesting ones that are coming up close to health. The second biggest motivator right now is taste, which I find so interesting because that speaks to the innovation. Like, people are curious about these plant-based products and they want to try them. And, you know, like I said before, over 70% of people are then going back and buying them again. So that innovation is so important for the industry. And there's a newness and a novelty about it, but then I think there's real staying power behind it as well. But also, I want to speak to some motivators that are extremely important to younger demographics, and that is around sustainability and the environment. And that is for the younger generations is so important when making purchase decisions and food decisions. And, you know, I've never seen this before where you see such a connection, especially with younger folks, to the environment and the food system. And, you know, there's just so much more awareness. I think that COVID has heightened that awareness and that connection between our food systems and the impact it has on the environment, and also on public health, more so than just than personal health as well. So the environmental benefits of plant-based foods over their animal-based counterparts is there. And that's an area the Plant-Based Foods Association is going to be doing more work in within the next 12 months. We're going to be doing life cycle assessments for across all the various categories of plant-based versus animal-based to really be able to demonstrate what is the reduction in terms of greenhouse gas emissions, in terms of land use, water use, nutrification and eutrophication. So what are those environmental benefits across all the categories? But that is going to be, as of course, like what's happening with younger demographics is an indicator of what's going to happen in the coming decades. That is something that all the plant-based food brands are going to be leaning into, I think, more and more. And PBFA is going to absolutely play a role in convening that information.
Yeah, and it is interesting. And it can be a little depressing that animals don't enter into this equation as much as these other issues. But I always feel like when you start caring about animals, you kind of have to do the whole thing. Like you said, it's like going vegan. It's a whole lifestyle change. So, you know, as I always say, you have to get the meat out of people's ears first before they can kind of hear that. So you're working on the people who are just trying these products out. And I think that at least a certain percentage of them do open up to the animal issue once they start realizing that you can eat perfectly good food, even if you start thinking about that issue. So it's not a totally unconnected issue. And I don't want people to despair that nobody will ever start caring about these poor creatures.
Yes, I agree. And that is another motivator, especially for younger demographics, that is becoming more and more important as well. So it's not even staying stagnant. It is becoming more and more important. So it does factor in, absolutely. Yeah.
I mean, obviously, another thing that's enormously important in what foods people buy is price. So how big a role do subsidies play in keeping plant-based foods from competing appropriately. And do you have plans to do anything about that?
That's a major focus for us as well, is the price piece. And, you know, a lot of times I get the question, how are we going to lower the price of plant-based products? And while I think that that's important to a degree, I feel like, and this is not, of course, the question that you asked, but sometimes I get this question, but that's not the angle we should come at. I think the way that you phrase the question is so appropriate, that we should be thinking about the subsidies and all the things that prop up animal agriculture that allow the price to be so artificially low. That's the root of the problem. Because if we are, you know, just putting pressure on the plant-based foods brands to get their prices lower and lower and lower, it's like they're not even working from, you know, an even playing field. And it's going to be extremely difficult and detrimental to their businesses. We need to be focused on how is it that animal products are so inexpensive on the supermarket shelves. And like you said, subsidies play a huge role in that. So it's a focus for our work, particularly, of course, our federal policy work. We'll be doing a lot of work on the Farm Bill, 2023 Farm Bill, and leading up to that, and really trying to get it to a place where plant-based food products can compete more fairly from a price standpoint. But also, I think that in addition to just the price, we need to be thinking about all of the negative externalities that are associated with animal agriculture and the impact that it has on the environment, on people's health, on the billions of animals, trillions of animals, we include aquatic animals as well, and on public health. And, you know, I think about the cost to human lives, which is something that really resonates with a lot of different groups. But most of our antibiotics that we use go into factory farming. And, you know, it's 70 to 80%, depending on what part of the globe, go into animal agriculture. And antibiotic resistance, the World Health Organization predicts that antibiotic resistance is going to kill more people by 2050 than cancer will. So that's like, you know, we're thinking about like all of those negative externalities associated with animal agriculture. And I think that needs to be part of the discussion too, when we talk about cost.
Absolutely.
Yes, there's just so many different layers to it, but yeah, subsidies are definitely part.
What about, in addition to trying to interrupt these subsidies that go to these commodity crops to be fed to animals, is there any support for increasing subsidies or something like them for the kind of crops that your people are using?
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the programs that we're working on specifically that ties into that is we are looking at what would it take to actually transition farmers from growing crops that are going into animal feed, that's part of the factory farming industry, to growing crops that are being used by plant-based food companies, crops that are being consumed directly by humans. So we launched this program. It's our domestic sourcing initiative, where we're working with farmers and then we're marrying them up with brands within the Plant-Based Foods Association membership that are looking to source more of their ingredients for their products domestically and are interested in that land transformation piece. And we're doing this, one, because it's what our member companies want. It will, you know, moving towards more regenerative and diversified farming systems is a great step. But also it's important to us that we are able to demonstrate what the economic benefit is to farmers and to rural communities, you know, what the benefit is beyond the economics as well, and being able to leverage that in our policy work when we're at the federal level.
Do you mean leverage it in your policy work by possibly gaining subsidies for those kinds of crops that would put them on a par with, you know, everybody just growing corn?
Yeah. So subsidies or incentives, it can take shape, but I think a number of different ways. But being able to demonstrate that there's huge potential if we put support measures in place for, you know, changing the way that we produce food in this country and make the use and make better use of our land and our resources.
That's a very exciting project. And it was one I wasn't aware of until we started talking. I love the idea of particularly of this pairing of these companies with farmers. I mean, that must make everybody feel a lot more secure. The companies are more secure that they'll be able to obtain their raw ingredients, and the farmers are more secure that they'll be able to sell their products. That, I mean, I'm sure it's much more complicated than that, but at its basis, it sounds like such a great idea. And I think that so many people are just completely unaware that virtually no, or actually no subsidies go to, you know, like nuts, seeds, alternative grains, fruits, vegetables, and they all go to corn and other animal feeds. It's just as unimaginable that this industry has come as far as it has, considering how disadvantaged it is by the government. And the industry, I would say, to me, that looks like it's the most on the ropes, I'd be interested to know if you agree, of all the animal-based agriculture industries, is cow milk. Is that true? Is that the most vulnerable for disappearing? Because it just seems like the most, I mean, it's not only hideous in an animal welfare, which is my particular focus, but there's so many things wrong with it. And it's just horrifying. Do you think that we might actually replace cow's milk and that will be an industry that will die? And if so, how long do you give it?
We are headed in that direction. I mean, the penetration that plant-based milk has made within the milk space is just tremendous. So plant-based milk accounts for over 16% of fluid milk sales in conventional grocery right now, but also in natural channels, which are often an indicator of what's going to happen in conventional, it's 50% of milk sales. So that's incredible. I know, like, we want it to be more than 50%. But like contrasting,
100 is the number I'm looking for.
100 is yes, yes. But like contrasting that to plant-based meat, that is between 1 and 2% of meat sales. So it is you know, really that category of the plant-based foods industry that has achieved that really incredible market penetration that I think we're going to see continuing. There is no indication that dairy milk sales are going to start making up some of those losses. So I think that trajectory will continue. I think one of the pieces for us to really get to that full displacement is thinking about that, like going back again to that farmer piece, that land use piece, because one of the pieces that we need to make sure is not attached to plant-based foods is we do not want to indicate at all that we are anti-farmer, that, you know, we don't care what happens if one part of the industry dies out. So it's really important that we are, all of us who are advocating for a transformation of the food system, are thinking about the humans that are part of this system. And that's, you know, one of the other reasons why PBFA is so focused on relationships with farmers, farming communities, other NGOs who specialize in this area, so that we can really work with farmers and rural America to transition. But there's also a disconnect between kind of this rhetoric that farmers who are part of animal agriculture right now are happy with this industry and with this business. There's corporations that benefit from this system, but then you have consumer sentiment moving in one direction, and then you have a lot of farmers who also feel like they are trapped in this system as well. So if we merge up with some of these, you know, partners who in some ways could seem to be unlikely allies, then I think that's where we can really start to make some more progress on that other remaining part of the industry that is still reliant on animals or on dairy cows.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's an enormously important focus. And I've always said, like, this idea that vegans are against farmers is just bizarre, because I don't know any group of people who likes to eat more than vegans. I mean, we're obsessed with food, and farmers grow food. Like, of course we like farmers. Like, what's not to like?
Yes.
I mean, and I do complain every once in a while that when we're talking about putting dairy farmers or whatever out of business, it's like people go out of business all the time and we don't worry about them. But at the same time, I think we should worry about all of them, not just dairy farmers, but we should, you know, and so we should obviously include dairy farmers among the people who we should worry about when industries shift. And yeah, they need help. And I'm sure you're right that they would love to get out of this business. All right. There's a million other things to talk about, but I'm going to have to let you go. But before I do, I'm just going to ask you one last really important question, is that when are you going to get Starbucks to drop the upcharge?
That is a very important question. That is, again, like it ties into the pricing piece and making sure that we make it so that these plant-based foods companies can get those products to Starbucks or any major food company at the same price that dairy milk is coming in. So, but I think as the industry continues to scale and grow and we make progress on policy initiatives that we're working on, the domestic sourcing initiatives, that is going to happen. And I think that point where we're going to reach price parity in this, particularly with milk, is not too far off.
All right. That's good news. We'll be waiting to hear about that. And I guess I've always thought that the upcharge was particularly unfair since plant-based milk lasts a lot longer than dairy milk. But, you know, it's Starbucks, so probably nothing lasts since they're always busy. People like their caffeine and they like it with milk, especially oat milk. All right. Thank you so much, Rachel, for joining us today. I really could talk to you for hours. This is such a fascinating topic and it's really been great.
Marianne, thank you so much. Such a pleasure being here.
If you like what you're listening to, and I hope you do, then please consider taking a minute out of your day today to leave us a friendly review. You can do it on Apple Podcasts or on Spotify or Stitcher or on Facebook or wherever you listen to podcasts or wherever you're listening to this. The more we get out there, the more our hen house will be in front of people's eyeballs when they're putting in search terms in their podcasts, and the more we could join forces together to elevate the voices of the animals and change the world for them. So thank you so much in advance for leaving us a friendly review.
Anxiety's arising. Our first story is fairly unbelievable. This was posted on Twitter, and it's regulations from the American Veterinary Medical Association. And they're talking about how to do depopulation, i.e. when they decide to kill all the animals because they can't market them. Or I guess for other reasons as well. All right. They actually discuss that this has a big impact on the people who have to do it. I'm just going to quote this whole thing. Direct and indirect involvement with depopulation activities can result in significant negative psychological impacts. The negative effects of bovine depopulation procedures on human psychological health have been well documented. Potential physical and psychological impacts related to depopulation activities should be considered when depopulation activities are planned. The use of experienced, just as an aside, like how do you get experienced depopulating? You just do it a lot? Anyway, the use of experienced, skilled depopulation personnel to lead efforts may improve overall animal welfare, as well as decrease human stress. The application of psychological first aid, when appropriate, may be beneficial. Like, is this Orwellian or what? All right. That's bad. This is worse. Same document. Efforts should be made to shield depopulation activities from being easily observed by the public. When appropriate, especially for large-scale depopulation events, the use of law enforcement to protect boundaries and maintain public safety is advisable. Yeah, I bet it is. I bet it is. Wow, this isn't even from the industry. It's from the AVMA. How do these people live with themselves? Do they ever think? All right. Our next story is from our friends over at the Plant-Based News. Regenuary. Animal farmers take aim at growingly popular Veganuary campaign. All right. As we know, Veganuary is a very, very successful campaign in the UK to encourage people to go vegan for January and hopefully to stay vegan. And last year, as I recall, they had something called February. The dairy industry had February, encouraging people to drink more cow's milk and eat cow's milk. That was apparently a disaster. So this year, they want people to not do Veganuary. They want people to do Regenuary instead. This is about adopting regenerative agriculture. And, you know, you've probably heard of regenerative agriculture, and it has a lot to do with allowing animals to graze. It is touted as a solution to the climate crisis, which is nonsense. So these kinds of farmers are getting together. Are they a cover for the whole industry? I mean, that's what this stuff always sounds like to me, that, you know, you encourage people, you say to people, oh yeah, meat can be done in a way that's fine. And people just keep eating meat. It's not go out and buy the expensive stuff that were grazed. Anyway, they want people to do this instead of Veganuary. The supporters say that by mimicking the grazing patterns of wild animals, livestock can feed off the land while fertilizing it. You know, ignoring the fact that we have way too much of the quote unquote fertilizer that these animals produce. And we certainly, you know, certainly need a lot less of it. And also, as this story points out, you could have domesticated animals if you really, really did need their manure. You could have them graze, you know, put horses out there, and you don't have to actually kill them and bring new ones into existence if you really need the manure that badly. Of course, you could also just not kill wild animals and chase them off the land, and, you know, they could poop on the land. Lots of ways to address this. They also say that they sequester carbon. However, I'll quote this in a report called Grazed and Confused. What a great name. Oxford University's Food Climate Research Network revealed only under very specific conditions can grazing help sequester carbon. This sequestering of carbon is even then small, time-limited, reversible, and substantially outweighed by the GHG emissions these grazing animals generate. So, yeah, that's not such a great benefit. Then there's the methane. I guess we're just not going to talk about the methane. Methane is the most important gas for us to reduce. And, you know, ruminants give off a lot of it. Land use, you need much, much more land for regenerative farming than for conventional farming. Conventional being, you know, in factory farms. And, you know, though, as I said, I just consider regenerative farming to be a cover for factory farming. And as this article concludes, regenerative grazing is a con. That's exactly right. It is a con. A classic case of conjurer's misdirection, because while we waste time debating this point, methane levels are rising fast, the atmosphere is warming, and our planet is dying. Yep, that's pretty much the way it is. All right, finally. This is an article from Iowa. Oh, actually, I'm sorry. It's from the Desert Sun. That's in, I believe the Desert Sun is in Utah. But it's talking about an Iowa farmer. As a hog farmer, I know why California's quote-unquote bacon law hurts consumers and pigs. This is by Dwight Mogler, and he is a farmer. And, you know, his pigs are so happy. And he was walking around his farm the other day, and it was 2 degrees out in Iowa, but the barns are a comfortable 68 degrees and quiet. I don't doubt that they heat the barns. I mean, pigs would die otherwise, so it doesn't really come as a surprise. But I love the way he puts this. A few sows vocalize, as we note, which may need extra care. Yeah, that's really going on. So what Dwight is worried about is this case, NPPC versus Ross, in which the industry made one of its many efforts to challenge the constitutionality of California's Prop 12, which they call the Bacon Law. I've never heard anybody call it the Bacon Law except for him. As Dwight says, I'm no legal scholar, but I wish they could walk my farm with me for a day. It might help them make up their minds. And who he's talking about is the Supreme Court, which has debated several times. It's been on the calendar several times for a decision as to whether they're going to grant review of the circuit's decision that Prop 12 was constitutional and California is allowed to set standards for the raising of animals whose meat is being sold in California. The industry proponents claim this is a violation of the Interstate Commerce Clause because it requires producers outside of California to follow those rules, but only if they want to sell pork in California. The law is pretty clear here, though the Supreme Court does seem to be dilly-dallying about whether they're going to review this, which means that maybe they're going to change the law, but they don't really want to change the law for any other reason other than to protect the pig industry. And he points out that each of his pregnant sows, who are apparently not in gestation crates, have 20 square feet of space. I just find this surprising that the California rules require 24 feet of space. So why doesn't he just put fewer pigs in the pen? I guess, you know, he just doesn't want to. And so he thinks it's a better idea to force California to not have any rules. A University of Minnesota study, he says, shows advantages and disadvantages to all the types of pig housing commonly used. They're always saying that. Of course, there are advantages and disadvantages because they're all horrible. So yeah, if you compare bad ones to not as bad ones, they're all going to have something bad about them. And so they give that as an excuse to, like, you know, just let us do whatever we want. Because California accounts for 15% or close to 15% of U.S. pork consumption, but does not have a huge pork industry itself, he says, as out-of-state hog farmers raise 99.9% of the nation's sows out of state of California, in-state producers in no way reduce the coercive power of the huge California market. I just love that. Like, they want to sell to California, and they don't want to follow California's rules. And the way they put this is that California's market is coercing them to raise pigs in a way they don't want to, i.e. with a tiny bit more space. They don't have to sell in California. They want to. They're not required to. They don't get arrested if they don't. Of course, he points out that the costs will be borne by consumers. You know, what about poor people? They always, like, bring out poor people, as if making pork producers richer will help all these poor people in California. That ain't going to happen. So the worst part, he concludes, is Proposition 12 was never about the well-being of animals or food safety, as claimed. The CDFA, that's the California Department of Food and Agriculture, hardly an animal rights organization, has stated it will have no effect on either. Well, who cares what the CDFA says? Of course it will. The proponents, animal rights activists, knew that compelling hog farmers to convert barns would drive many to close, meaning higher prices, less demand, and fewer hogs. Well, that is a good feature. I hope that's what it means. I don't know. And, you know, the proponents, animal rights activists, it's true that many animal rights activists were proponents of it. But you know who it was passed by? It was passed by the people of California. Don't they get to do what they want? And that's it for this week's Rising Anxieties.
Well, that's it for this week's show. As always, if you like the podcast and if you're able, we invite you to join the flock at ourhenhouse.org/donate for $10 a month or $100 a year. Or you can make whatever donation you're comfortable with. Another way to support us is to leave us a fabulous review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts, or like us on Facebook. You could also leave us a review there or follow us on Twitter or Instagram at Our Hen House. If you shop on Amazon, you can use Amazon Smile using Our Hen House as your favored charity. And of course, tell your friends about us. If you're one of our listeners who already supports us, thank you so much. And thank you to my co-host, Marianne Sullivan, and to Jen Riley for her work in producing this podcast, to composer Michael Herron for the music. Thanks to Eric Montgomery of the Podcast Haven for his work editing this podcast, and to our production assistant, Jocelyn Martinez, and to Vicki Bischler for her membership and administrative help. We'd also like to give a shout out to the amazing Veronica Kalinska, who designed our brand new logos and other graphics. We'll be back next week with a brand new episode, so don't forget to subscribe in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. I'm Jasmine Singer. Thank you so much for tuning in.